Who? Grace smiled.
Aunt Sally is the DMS's chief of operations. She runs the hangar, our Brooklyn facility.
And you call her Aunt Sally? Kind of conjures an image of a blue-haired maiden aunt with too many cats. Should I assume that you believe this Aunt Sally person is trustworthy and hasn't left her scrambler lying in her knitting basket?
Dietrich smiled. If you're lucky, Captain, no one will ever tell her you said that.
Grace's smile broadened, and it youthened her, stripping away several layers of tension.
Even Church looked amused, though with him it was harder to tell.
I think those of us who know her can safely vouch for Aunt Sally's integrity.
What about force? Could someone have taken the scrambler from her?
I would truly love to see someone try, said Church.
Across from him, Dietrich was laughing quietly and nodding to himself, apparently visualizing the scenario. The laughter and smiles, however, died away. I glanced at Rudy, who was quietly observing everyone. I imagined that he, like I, realized that the laughter was a pressure valve. The enormity of what had happened in Room 12 loomed over us. Church's phone rang, and when he looked at the displayed number, he held up a finger and took the call, speaking quietly for a couple of minutes.
"Thanks for getting back to me so quickly," he said. "Please keep me informed."
He clicked the phone off and laid it on the table, and any trace of humor that had been on his face was completely gone now.
"That was a contact of mine at the Atlanta office of the Bureau. Henry Cherescu, the engineer who designed the code scrambler, is dead. His body was found in his apartment this morning, and he'd been dead for about 30 hours. Cleaning lady found him and called the police. No suspects, but the report says that Cherescu's apartment, which doubles as his workshop, was trashed. A complete report will be faxed to us.
Damn, I said. Sorry about your friend, Church, but I bet I can tell you what'll be in that report. Most likely it'll look like an ordinary break-in by a junkie. TV and DVD player will be gone, there'll be lots of random damage, a big mess. The smartest way to hide a small crime is to make it look like a bigger one. I'll bet Cherescu probably had the design schematics of his scrambler somewhere, maybe hard copy or on his computer. The hard drive will be gone, too, in most of his papers.
Very likely, Church said.
He took another cookie and pushed the plate toward me. I poked through them and took an elephant and a monkey.
So where does that leave us?
Grace asked.
With a certain knowledge that we've been infiltrated by someone with an understanding of what the DMS is, Church said. And someone who knows me well enough to know how I obtain equipment.
That can't be a long list, Rudy suggested.
It isn't, Church agreed. And I'll be taking a look at that list once this meeting is concluded.
It still leaves one or more persons inside the DMS, I said. Inside this building.
Excuse me, Rudy said. But am I to presume that if we are here in this room, then we are not on the list of potential suspects?
Church leaned back in his chair and studied Rudy for a few moments, one index finger tracing a slow circle on the tabletop.
Dr. Sanchez, there are very few people I trust implicitly, and in each case that trust is based on many years of experience, opportunity, and evaluation. As for most of the people gathered here, my trust is based on more recent knowledge. You and Captain Ledger were in the science lab with me and were then escorted to your quarters. Major Cortland was with me, and Sergeant Dietrich had just completed his rounds with two other officers. One of them walked him to his quarters.
Okay, but doesn't that indicate that we were not directly involved in opening the door? What makes you sure we're not accomplices?
Church bit an edge off a cookie, munched it.
I haven't said that I have cleared you of all suspicion, Dr. Sanchez, but as you already said, you can presume that if you're in this room, then you are not high on the list of suspects.
That seemed to satisfy Rudy, at least in part, because he gave a curt nod and lapsed back into observant silence.
We've brought a lot of people on board in the last couple of days, Dietrich said. The movers? More than half of the security team, the decorators, some new lab techs?
He paused and looked directly at me.
And all of Echo Team.
How good was the screening for all of these people? I asked.
Grace said, We have three FBI agents on loan to us working as screeners. You've met them, Joe. Agents Simcheck, Andrews, and McNeil, the agents who picked you up in Ocean City.
Buckethead and his cronies, I thought. Okay, but who screens the screeners?
I do,
Grace admitted, and I could see a troubled look in her eyes. She knew that I had to be thinking about her oversight with the task force logs regarding me and the second panel truck. She'd been under tremendous stress since the massacre at St. Michael's. Stress isn't conducive to a calm and meticulous approach. I kept that to myself for now, and I think I caught a flicker of a grateful nod from her.
I've been supervising the actual screens, though, added Dietrich. If this is someone who slipped through because of sloppy work, then it's on me.
I liked that he made no attempt to weasel out of anything. Dietrich was Church's pet bulldog, and he seemed blunt and honest. I liked him. And he was low on my personal list of suspects.
Another question, I said. Where are we recruiting from? You gave me files on the Echo Team guys, along with a big stack of other possible candidates. Some of those are generic folders off the shelf from Staples, but some were FBI, a few were military, a couple were even marked top secret. Am I right in assuming that you're recruiting from all of the military and federal agencies?
And law enforcement, Dietrich added with a nod in my direction.
How? I thought you guys were secret.
Secrecy is conditional, Captain, Church said. We all have to answer to someone, and the DMS answers directly to the president.
He paused, then added,
A few days ago, I met with the Joint Chiefs and the heads of the FBI, CIA, ATF, NSA, and several other branches. I was asked by the president to give a brief description of the DMS and its mission, and to then make requests that each department or branch of service provide me with a list of candidates for inclusion in the DMS. The files were sent to us, and Agent Simcheck and his team of screeners did evaluations and ran each candidate through Mind Reader. Anyone with even a twitch in his or her records was discounted. I will admit, however, that there was a bias toward individuals with skill sets that are appropriate to the current crisis, and that may be our hole. Simcheck and his team may have somehow erred on the side of immediate need. That, or the traitor has a spotless record and rang no alarms.
If he was Black Ops or Delta Force, Grace offered, then his records might have been altered or sealed. Field agents' names are often deleted from records of actions, especially when the agent is active military and the action technically illegal. Assassinations and infiltrations over enemy lines. It's all plausible deniability, which means this bugger could hide even from Mind Reader.
What kind of person are we looking for? Rudy asked. A rogue government agent? A terrorist sympathizer?
Unknown, Grace said. All we know is that this person, or persons, unlocked room 12 for reasons unknown.
Church nodded.
This impacts you most of all, Captain. We don't know how or even if this relates to the planned raid on the crab plant. Before the meeting, Major Cortland advised me to push it back. Sergeant Dietrich wants to hit it with all the troops and go for a clean sweep. The mission is yours to call, however.
Jesus Christ, Rudy said. He just came out of a combat situation. Two combat situations.
I touched his arm to stop him. No, Rudy. You can get me on the couch later, but right now I can hear the clock ticking big time. If what happened in room 12 is not directly related to the crab plant, then I'll eat Sergeant Dietrich's gym socks.
I'll cook them for you, said Dietrich.
Church, I said, about hitting the crab plant at dawn?
Yes.
Fuck that, I want to hit it right now.
Rudy gasped, but Church nodded.
I figured you would. Choppers are on deck, and my computer team is getting your communications gear ready.
I grinned at him.
Joe, said Grace, are you sure about this?
Sure? No. I'd rather hit that place with a 500-pound bomb and scratch them off the to-do list, but now, more than ever, we need to go soft and see about nabbing some prisoners. I think we should plan immediate interrogations, though.
Okay. Grace said. My team will be ready to rush the door at the first sign of trouble. But if you want everyone else to remain back at an unobtrusive distance, then it still leaves us with a 5 to 10 minute lag for a full-on attack.
Joe, that's suicide, Rudy barked. There's no way that you could—
It's my call, I said firmly. And I can't think of a better plan that we could put into action right now. The longer we wait, the more time there is for the spy to get a message out.
No messages are going out right now, Church said. We have jammers running everywhere in the building. However, we still have to consider the possibility that messages and intelligence may have been sent out before the lockdown.
I sat back and looked from face to face.
Okay, but we're going to need a diversion. Here's what I have in mind. Part 3. Beasts. Until the day of his death, no man can be sure of his courage. Jean Anouilh. Chapter 56. The DMS Warehouse, Baltimore. Tuesday, July 1st, 12:59 a.m. Echo Team came jogging into the big room at the warehouse looking very much awake. Wired, scared, and thoroughly pissed off, but awake. I told them to gear up, and they followed Gus Dietrich over to the arms locker. Alpha Team was already there. Rudy turned to Church.
This is killing you, isn't it?
Church looked at him.
Rudy said,
I don't know you, Mr. Church. We've only had some weird little talks.
He waved a hand. Zombies and all that.
But since what happened in Room 12, I've been thinking about this situation, about this organization you've constructed. I know only enough about the military to know that this isn't the way things are done, and I do know enough about governments to know that the DMS operates on its own schedule. It's virtually red tape free. Lots of authority, and it's shared.
He chewed his lip for a moment.
Your background has to include some training or practical experience, either in psychology, therapy, or psychological manipulation, maybe all three. You know how to set a mood and cultivate trust. You apparently care about the well-being of your staff. You like toys, and you pride yourself on having the best toys in the schoolyard. The labs here are bizarrely overdone. You have equipment I've never heard of, let alone seen in actual use. Everyone I've met here has an above-average IQ. A lot of individuals, not a lot of team players.
Your point being? Church asked, though if he was impatient or unnerved, it didn't show.
What Joe and I are seeing is probably DMS light. I'll bet your Brooklyn hangar is AJ squared away. The tightest security checks and double checks, a lot of security redundancies. But down here you've had to put this facility together in days. Mind you, what you've accomplished in those days is incredible, and I frankly would never have thought it was possible to do. You're a remarkable man, Mr. Church.
I don't need an ego stroke, Doctor, nor am I in the mood to give you one, Rudy said with a touch of asperity in his voice.
My point is that out of necessity you've had to put this whole thing together too fast and under too much pressure. The Brooklyn model is probably a good one, but for it to be as tight as you want it would require time, more time than you have. You've probably had to call in markers, ask for favors from other agencies. You've probably had to go through channels in ways you normally wouldn't. And as a result, the local reality of the DMS station here at the warehouse has holes in it. And as a result of that, people have died.
Hey, Rude, come on, man, I said softly. He ignored me.
I'm not saying any of this to blame you, Mr. Church, not at all. My point is that you are up against the wall, and all of the practiced cool in the world can change the effect that has on you as a physical being. Brain chemistry is only ever partially under our control. You are under tremendous physical and psychological strain, and right now you are probably tearing yourself up inside because of what happened in Room 12.
I don't think we really have time for this, Church said, but his eyes never left Rudy's face. I don't think he even blinked.
We don't have time for us to get into it as deeply as we need to, Rudy said. But we have to address it, in part, right now. My friend's life is being put on the line. For the third time today. My own life is potentially in jeopardy as long as I'm in this facility and as long as there is a traitor here.
We're all at risk.
No, that's not what I mean, and I think you know that. I'm not asking you to open up to me, Church, not here and not ever, unless you choose to. But what I am saying is you have to acknowledge that these events and the presence of the traitor are connected to actions you've taken.
He held up a finger to keep Church from interrupting him.
Actions you have had to take. If we could wind this back and start over again, I don't know if there is anything that could have been done differently. This may be an inevitable occurrence given the circumstances. Therefore, you need to bear in mind that today's events may have been beyond your control. Yes, you need to tighten security in any way you can. Hindsight advises that. Yes, you need to conduct your search for the traitor, leaving no stone unturned. Yes, you need to triple-check the backgrounds of every single person in the DMS, especially recent hires. But, and this is the real point, you have to keep focused, eyes on the prize, and not let guilt or anger deflect you from the primary purpose here, which is to stop the terrorists from launching this dreadful weapon. If today's tragedy throws you off your game, then we could all die. My advice to you, Mr. Church, is to take your guilt and anger and put them on a shelf, at least until Joe and his team are back from the crab plant. Stay focused, and stay in charge.
Church said nothing for maybe 5 seconds.
Do you think I'm unaware of these things, Doctor?
I don't know what you're aware of, Mr. Church. You keep your emotions under check better than anyone I've ever met. But no matter how tough you are, and I imagine you are one very tough hombre, you are still human. Inside you might be seething with rage, and if God is kind, I hope he never puts me in your path when you're enraged. You and Joe are a lot alike in that. Controlled most of the time. But there is a point where control goes all to hell and what is left is pure, lethal rage. That's all well and good if you find yourself, God forbid, in a room full of walkers, but I would not like to think that the man directing the subtleties of an operation of this kind is going on rage and looking for payback. The problem is that with you, I can't tell how close to a loss of control you are. You aren't a robot, so you have to be suppressing your emotions. Just remember that suppressing emotions is not the same thing as actually removing emotions from your physiological makeup. If you're as smart a man as I think you are, then you'll consider what I've said. You have to recognize distracting emotions and make very, very sure that they don't affect the decisions you make and the time frame in which those decisions are made.
Rudy took a small half-step back. It was as if he diminished in size from a giant to an ordinary man in that subtle move. He switched off his perceptual X-ray, withdrew his own energy from the moment, and left a gap for Church to fill. How Church filled that gap would make all the difference, and I wished I could be inside Rudy's head to see how he was measuring the moment. Church was silent for maybe 15 seconds. I held my breath. Then Church gave one of his fractional smiles and a short nod.
I'll take it under advisement.
Rudy studied him, and he must have found something in the stone mask that was Church's face, because he nodded in return.
Fair enough.
Hey, guys, I said, I hate to break up this Dr. Phil moment, but I kind of have to go fight some zombies.
Rudy said something very foul in Spanish, and Church turned away to assess the teams, though I think he really did it to hide a smile. Chapter 57. The DMS Warehouse, Baltimore, Tuesday, July 1st, 1:16 a.m. We piled into the helicopter, an SH-60 Seahawk fitted out with every kind of gun pod and missile launcher in the catalog. Once we were in and the door closed, we huddled down and switched to helmet mics so everyone could hear above the rotor noise. Church joined us. He put an open pack of small high-protein cereal bars on one corner of the map. Combat version of cookies, I thought. Guy was a freak. When we'd boarded, I pushed Rudy into a corner. Sit tight, watch and listen, I said. He nodded, looking scared. He was going only as far as the staging area, but I wanted him next to Church throughout. The Seahawk's big T-700 GE-701C engines roared, and the bird lifted off and headed southeast at 150 knots with three other helos, two of them bearing Alpha Team and the other with support staff, in close formation.
Here's the bottom line, I began once everyone was settled down around the map. Someone bypassed the security and opened the door to room 12. As a result, we have 10 casualties, 6 medical staff, our prisoner, and 3 soldiers, plus one other soldier who has been bitten and infected by the walkers. That means that pretty soon he'll be dead too. Bunny and Top said nothing. They'd been there. Ollie ran a shaking hand through his hair. Skip looked 10 years old and terrified.
Who did it? Skip asked.
Unknown at this time.
This was an accident, right? Ollie said.
I let silence answer that.
Oh, man, he said. He looked down at the stock of his MP5.
Skip was a half step slower.
Wait. You mean this wasn't an accident? Someone did this on purpose?
Are we talking a spy here? Ollie asked. Or a terrorist infiltrator?
We have to look at both options, Church said, and when Ollie started to say something, he added, and until further notice, this discussion is over.
My guys all looked at me. And despite what Church just said, I wanted to put my own stamp on things. Right now, we don't know who did this or how many infiltrators we have, so until further notice, everyone, and I do mean everyone, is a suspect. You don't like it? Too bad. I'm not asking for comments right now, but hear me on this. I will find out who did this, and when I do, that person is going to live forever in a world of hurt. If anyone knows or learns anything connected with this, I want to hear about it. Come to me in private. Talk to me one-on-one. I'm offering a white flag for contact, but it expires in 24 hours, after which I'm going to be witch hunting under a black flag. I want to know what you hear and understand.
Hurrah, growled Top.
Bunny nodded.
Loud and clear, boss.
Yes, sir, said Skip.
Ollie bared his teeth.
We find whoever tried to rat-fuck us, you hold him, and I'll cut his balls off.
The tension in the air was thick as quicksand. I handed out intelligence briefs. Read through the materials. You have 15 minutes. Questions? I asked when they all put the intel reports down. Bunny cleared his throat.
Boss, not to be a pain in the ass, but all I've been reading here is we don't know this and we don't know that. I mean, what do we know?
What do you want to know?
Well, Bunny said to Church, for a start, who are the hostiles? Saying terrorist kind of tells me dick, sir.
I'll tell you what I told Captain Ledger, Church said. The cell taken down by the task force represents a broad range of terrorist and extremist groups.
He turned and looked at Bunny, who was making a face.
Go on, Sergeant, he encouraged. Ask it.
How does that make sense? I mean, sure, we all call it the international terrorist community, but it's not like they all get together for bowling night. It's not a club, right? But we're supposed to believe that these guys are what, a terrorist coffee clatch?
There were some chuckles, and even Church managed a small smile. Probably fake, but still there.
You find that to be unlikely? You're an NCO with 8 years in, and you think Homeland is wrong in the way it interpreted the task force intelligence?
He stared at Bunny, and Bunny gave it right back to him.
Yes, sir, I think it's bullshit.
Church gave that smile again.
Of course you do, Sergeant. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here.
He let that sink in for a moment.
And if any of you ever accept info without thinking it through and raising reasonable questions, you'll be out of here so fast you'll get motion sick.
Then,
Bunny hadn't expected that kind of comeback, and it derailed him for a moment.
Tell me what we should infer, Sergeant, Church prompted. Because the intel, as far as details go, is correct. Those men were from different groups. We verified that. Homeland thinks this means the terrorist community is uniting to form a front against America. What do you think of that?
Bunny cut a look at me, and I nodded. I liked that Bunny was following the same logic I'd explored with Church.
Well, he said, grabbing onto a leather strap as the chopper banked into a climbing turn. We got a lot of ears and eyes out there. CIA got spooks out the yin-yang. Every branch of the service has their M1 guys wiretapping the shit out of the whole Middle East. If the extremists were forming some kind of axis of evil, and here he paused for a laugh and got it, then there's no way we wouldn't have heard at least something about it all this time and we don't hear a peep. No fucking way.
Go on,
Now Church's smile seemed genuine.
So, has anyone thought that instead of this being the start of the terrorist mighty marching society, it's more like a kind of, what do you call it, a brain trust?
Keep going, I said.
Maybe someone, maybe the sick fuck who cooked up this prion bullshit, kind of had a great idea but needed an A-team to make it work. Not your run-of-the-mill fanatics, but guys with real brain cells. The report from Doctor Who says that this is, how'd he put it, radically advanced technology, so somehow our bad guy puts the word out that he's recruiting top-of-the-line only.
I don't buy it, said Ollie.
Me neither, agreed Top Sims. That'd be in the wind, too. We'd have heard something. No. This smart sumbitch has a pipeline into the terrorist community, and he's directly recruiting one-to-one. It'd be safer that way.
Sure, Ollie agreed. Easier to keep it all on the down low.
But that brings up another problem, said Bunny. But then he shook his head. No, maybe a lead. If he's recruiting outside of his own group, then you've got to figure there's going to be a percentage of times he's going to get turned down. Not everyone's going to want to play that kind of baseball. If this guy is as smart as he seems to be, then he wouldn't let anyone just stroll off who has even a whiff of what he's doing.
Skip snapped his fingers.
Right. We should check international records to see if any terrorists with known skills in high-end weapons or medicine have gone off the board. This guy would probably kill anyone who doesn't sign with his team.
Church turned to me.
Your team seems to be able to read your mind.
To the men, he said, Captain Ledger had the same thought, and as a result, I've initiated just such a database search. At his suggestion, we've also begun searching for non-terrorist-affiliated scientists in the appropriate fields who may have disappeared or whose family members are conspicuously missing.
Scientists might take all sorts of radical research risks if their wife or daughter were sitting somewhere with a gun to their heads, Top agreed. My kids were in that kind of danger, there's nothing I wouldn't do.
I saw a shadow pass over his face, and remembered that he'd buried his son and saw his daughter crippled for life because of this war.
I said, Okay, tell us why our mystery man is searching so far out of his own group.
Bunny was about to speak, but Ollie got there first.
'Cause even in a large group or small country, you're not going to have enough top minds in the right fields who are also extremists willing to die for their cause.
Right, Skip said.
Top nodded.
Yeah, that's too much to ask, and it's too shallow a fishing hole. You need to pick and choose. You need to find the right guys. Smart as a motherfucker and willing to die. That's gotta be a small club, even worldwide.
What I'm saying, Bunny agreed, nodding. This stuff is slick. Really slick.
He sipped some coffee from a metal travel mug and looked at Church and me over the rim.
No one at Homeland thought of that?
Red tape and too many levels of bureaucracy can impede practical thought, Church said.
Which is a nice way of saying they have their thumbs up their asses, Ollie interpreted.
Church said nothing, but he didn't appear to disagree.
Top narrowed his eyes and looked appraisingly at Church.
Sir, I pretty much know why you picked us and those science geeks you got on our team. I'm going to guess there's not one of them that ever scored second best in the school science fair.
Church smiled.
So what we have here, Skip said, is an all-star squad.
Ollie grinned.
Okay, so they got a geek squad and the DMS has a geek squad. But you also got a crew of first-team shooters. Who do they have?
I said, Javad Mustafa, one player on their team, started an outbreak that wiped out two DMS teams and over 200 civilians. You saw firsthand what the walkers did to those kids and to the guards and lab techs in Delaware, and you know what happened in Room 12. We have shooters. They have walkers.
That shut everyone up for a while, and we sat there in the belly of the chopper as it tore through the Maryland skies.
Surprise was a big factor in the loss at the hospital. Same goes for what happened last night, I said. What are the chances that any of us are going to be surprised if we run into a walker at the crab plant? Bunny snorted.
If it moans and moves, I'm going to kill it.
Hoo-ah, they all said together.
And if there are a lot of them? Church asked.
I killed me a bunch of walkers in Delaware, sir, said Top.
and I was in a good mood. After room 12, I'm a mite pissed off.
Fucking A, Skip agreed.
Fine, Church said. But here's the thing. Echo Team is going into the plant for a look, no touch. As you rightly put it, our intel is weak. The mission objective is to get more information because we got virtually nothing of worth from Delaware. If it looks like a pullback and rethink, then that's what we'll do. We have the option to upgrade into an assault, but there are some operational priorities which include securing undamaged computers and drives, and apprehending suspects. If you have to pull triggers, then try, and I mean really try, to bring me back someone with a pulse.
Skip said, I thought that these clowns die after 6-8 hours unless they take a pill. How are you going to sweat info out of them with that kind of deadline?
Mr. Church's face was stone.
My copy of the Geneva Convention got burned up in a fire. I won't need 6 hours.
They were four very tough men, and every one of them was scared, silent by the uncompromising tone of his voice. After a moment, Ollie cleared his throat.
What do we do if we run into armed resistance?
If you draw fire, you return fire. This is not a suicide mission, Lieutenant Brown. I've already buried too many of my people in the last week.
He paused to make sure everyone was giving him every bit of their attention. You will try to accomplish the mission objectives in priority order, but you do what you have to do to come back alive.
Okay, I said. Eyes on the map.
The crab processing plant is located on the Chesapeake Bay off Tangier Sound. The southwest side of the building fronts the Pocomoke River 800 yards from where the river spills out into the bay. There's a wooden dock where crab boats tie up. The rest of the property is a U-shaped parking lot. Lots of open ground.
Ollie tapped the map.
Almost no cover. If they have cameras with night vision, we'd be chopped to pieces. We'll need some kind of diversion or another route in.
I have something in mind, I said. The building is one story, flat, and about 55,000 square feet. Before it was used for seafood, it was a boat storage warehouse, but has since been converted. We know from the building inspector's report from this past January that the northeast corner is used for offices and bulk storage. Empty containers, labels, rolls of plastic wrap, that sort of thing. The rest is the actual plant.
They still processing crabs in there? Skip asked.
Negative. The place is in receivership. The original staff was laid off on February 15th.
So, okay, if this place is closed, then why are there, what, 8-9 vehicles in the lot?
That's one of those things we don't know, I said.
Under ordinary circumstances, I would presume that they're there to oversee the company's reorganization, but these three trucks here are all of the same make and model as the one followed to the crab plant by the task force.
Trucks carrying what? Bunny asked.
Cargo unknown, but it could have been one or more of those big blue cases.
Ollie narrowed his eyes as he studied the satellite image.
What kind of traffic in or out since then?
Except for a security guard? I said.
None.
Top looked dubious.
We see anyone other than the guard?
I shook my head.
No.
Just the one guard, and he works 4 10-hour shifts a week, from 10 at night to 6 a.m. Long-range photos have ID'd him as Simon Walford, age 53, a rent-a-cop from a company based in Elkton, though Walford lives right up the road. He worked the plant for 2 years and change.
We know anything about him? Skip asked.
Nothing that fits the profile of a terrorist sympathizer. Widowed, lives alone, no military record, no arrests, no memberships in anything except Netflix and BJ's Wholesale. Cheats on his taxes, but it's penny-ante stuff to hide income from a side business he has repairing 2-stroke engines, lawnmowers, weed whackers. Son owns a lawn care business. His bank records show what you'd expect, virtually no savings, no portfolio, and maybe $2,000 in checking. Not living check to check, but close enough. His email is clean, and about the only thing he uses the internet for is classmates.com. His 35th high school reunion is in August.
So he's a nobody, Skip concluded, but Bunny and Top both turned to him.
That's not what the man said, boy, Top snapped. He said that he has no trail doesn't mean the same thing as no involvement.
Trust no one, said Bunny.
Didn't you ever watch The X-Files?
Skip colored.
I went over this guy's profile, I said.
And sure, it looks like he's okay, but he could be anything from a turncoat to a closet mercenary to a convert to the cause. Or he could be clueless. We don't know until we get there. Just the one guard? Skip said, eager to correct his mistake. 4 shifts a week? 1 we've seen, Church corrected, pleased with the observation. He leaned over and slid the box of cereal bars toward the young sailor. Skip hesitated and then took a granola one and looked at it for a full 5 seconds without opening it. I wondered if he was going to have it framed. The grounds are not patrolled during the day, I said. When Walford goes home, he locks the gate from the outside. Except for Walford, no one else has come or gone.
If I say, that's weird, I won't get a cookie, will I?
Bunny said, and Church kind of smiled. Bunny reached out and took a chocolate cereal bar with a Mother May I expression on his face. He tore it open and popped it in his mouth. There was a burst of squelch, and the pilot's voice said, ETA 40 minutes. Okay, guys, assessment, I said, and everyone's face sharpened. Skip said, 9 vehicles, so we got 9 potential hostiles.
Truck had 2, Ollie said, looking at his notes, so make it 10.
No, Top said, rustling his copy of the intel report. Look at page 4. Trucks are registered to the company, probably parked there on a regular basis, which means that the 2 guys who drove it there likely commuted in by car. We have 6 cars in the lot.
He looked up.
Thermal scans?
Place packed seafood, Church said. They got ice machines and refrigeration, thermal signals a week. We've picked up a max of 4 weak human signals at one time. Distortion is too bad to permit any useful guesses as to how many people are in there.
Whoa, Bunny said. If this place has been shut down since the beginning of the year, why the hell are they running ice machines and fridges?
I beamed at him. That's a damn good question, isn't it? Church considered him for a moment, then pushed the package of cereal bars all the way over to Bunny. Skip looked crushed.
Shit, Top muttered. So we got no idea what the hell we're stepping into. Could be 20 people in there. Could be 20 of those dead-ass zombies in there, too.
We have to be open to any possibility, I agreed. Church nodded. We know this. As of the presidential order in my jacket pocket, that crab plant is now designated enemy soil. Rules of war apply. The Constitution is suspended. Hostiles are designated as enemy combatants.
Sucks to be them, Bunny said, munching a cookie.
Chapter 58. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 2:33 a.m. We touched down behind a volunteer fire station 1 mile from the plant. A second chopper stood nearby, and the lot was crammed with all manner of official vehicles, most of them painted to look nondescript, but I've seen enough of them to tell. We piled out and hurried in through the station's back door. Gus Dietrich was already there, standing by 2 wheeled racks of equipment. Each member of the team was issued a communicator that looked like a streamlined Bluetooth. By tapping the earpiece, we could change channels. Channel 1 was secured for team communication, which would be monitored by Church and his command group in a van that was parked 1/2 mile away from the plant. Other channels were for full team operations, should it become necessary to bring in the special ops, SWAT, and other specialists on standby. 1 channel was reserved as my private line to Church. The Saratoga hammer suits had arrived, and we all tried them on. They fit like loose coveralls and were surprisingly comfortable and mobile. I did some kicks and punches in the air while wearing my suit, and even with the Kevlar vest and other limb padding, it didn't slow me down much at all. Bunny's was a bit tighter, and he looked like a stuffed sausage. We had our choice of weapons. I still didn't have a sound suppressor for my .45, so I kept the Beretta M9. And anyway, it was lighter and already loaded with 9mm Parabellum hollow points. When I looked up, I saw Rudy watching me, his eyes showing doubt and concern. "Civis pacem parabellum," I quoted as I holstered the gun. He squinted as he worked out the translation.
"If you seek peace, prepare for war."
"Hoorah," Top murmured from a few feet away.
"That the trademark of the gun manufacturer?" Rudy asked.
"No," I said as I checked the magazine and slapped it back into place. "The ammunition is a 9mm Parabellum. The name comes from a quote by the Roman writer Publius Flavius Vegetius Renatus."
At least formal education wasn't wasted on you, Rudy said.
He cleared his throat.
Good luck to all of you. Come back safely.
He backed away and sat on the rear bumper of one of the fire trucks, hands in his lap, fingers knotted together in a nervous tangle. He was sweating, but I doubt it had anything to do with the heat of this humid July night. I gave him a wink as I put extra magazines in a Velcro pouch around my waist. Each of my four guys had MP5s fitted with quick-release sound suppressors. I strapped a sturdy fighting knife to my calf, the Ranger combat knife, which is 10¾ inches from pommel to the tip of its black stainless steel blade, and is nicely balanced for close fighting or throwing. Grace Cortland's chopper landed while my men were checking each other's equipment. She led Alpha Team in, and they immediately began sorting out their hammer suits. She walked over to me.
"Enjoying your first day with the DMS?"
she said with a wicked grin.
"Yeah, I find it very relaxing."
"Well, maybe tomorrow we can go find some bombs to defuse.
It'd make a nice change." She grinned at me, but I could see ghosts behind her smiling eyes. St. Michael's was still as current for her as Delaware and Room 12 were for me. The mark was there in her eyes, and I knew she could see it in mine. I found the mutual recognition weirdly comforting.
"How's your team?"
she asked. "Ready to do their jobs. Yours?"
"My team will be on deck throughout. You say the word, and we'll come running."
She paused.
"I wish I was going in with you."
"Thanks," I said. "When this is over, I would like to get drunk. Care to join me?" She studied my face for a moment.
"That sounds lovely. I'll buy the first round."
She offered me her hand.
"You're a good man, Joe. Church thought so all along, and he's seldom wrong. Sorry it took so long for me to catch up."
I took her hand. Water under the bridge.
"Don't get killed,"
she said, trying to make a joke of it, but her eyes were a little glassy. She turned quickly away and headed over to where her team was loading their gear into the back of a fire truck. I looked around and saw Church about 50 yards away just closing his cell phone. I signaled to him and went over. "Before we roll, I want to set a few things in motion," I said. "I want you to start building me a top-of-the-line forensics team. No second stringers and nobody I don't know personally."
"Who do you have in mind?"
I pulled a sheet of paper out of my pocket. "This is a list of forensics people I know and trust. Most of all, I want Jerry Spencer from D.C. I believe you already know him."
"We offered to bring him on board, but he declined."
"Make a better offer. Jerry is the best crime scene man I ever met."
"Very well."
Church touched my arm.
"We have no leads at all on who the spy might be, Captain. That means it could be anyone."
He was looking past me to where Echo and Alpha teams were gearing up.
"Watch your back."
He offered his hand, and I took it. I turned away and yelled out loud, "Echo team, let's roll!" Chapter 59. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 2:51 a.m. The 4th of July was still 3 days away, but there were already fireworks. Not a pretty star field or fiery chrysanthemums in the night sky. This was a single bloom of intense orange-red that soared upward from the edge of a weather-worn set of wooden steps that led from the choppy waters of the Tangier Sound to the creosote planking of the dock at the Blue Point Crab and Seafood Processing Plant in Crisfield. The impact followed the roar of heavy marine engines as a blue cigarette boat fishtailed through the black water while an apparently drunk pilot struggled sloppily for control. The boat hit the dock at full throttle and exploded, the fuel tanks rupturing from the impact and igniting from the laboring engine. There was a deep-throated roar like an angry dragon, and flames shot upward to paint the entire sound in shades of Halloween orange and fireplace red. It was too early in the morning for witnesses, but there were dozens of people sleeping aboard their anchored boats, and within a few minutes each of them was on a cell phone or ship-to-shore radio. Almost immediately the air was rent with the piercing screams of fire engines and ambulances tearing along the country roads. Simon Walford was on duty in his guard shack reading a David Morrell novel by lamplight and sipping coffee when the boat hit the dock. He spilled half a cup down the front of his uniform shirt and was sputtering in shock as he keyed the radio handset to try and call the incident in to his supervisor, who did not answer the call.
It had been 2 days since Walford had spoken to anyone in the plant, and 2 weeks since he had seen a single living soul. The cars were all still in the lot, though. It didn't make sense. He grabbed his walkie-talkie, ran out of his booth, and raced across the parking lot to the dock, but as soon as he saw the flames, he knew there would be no hope of finding survivors. The heat from the blaze kept him well back. All he got was a glimpse of a blackened form hunched forward in the pilot's seat, his body wreathed in flames, his limbs as stiff and unmoving as a mannequin.
"Good God," Walford breathed.
He called it into 911, but even before the call went through, he could hear sirens in the distance. Had he been a little less shocked by what had happened, he might have been surprised at how incredibly fast the local volunteer fire department had been able to respond to the crisis, especially at that time of night. As it was, all he could think of was how helpless he felt. He tried his supervisor's number again, but still got the answering machine, so he left an urgent and almost incoherent message. Shocked and impotent, he trudged back to his station and unlocked the fence to allow the fire trucks to enter. Chapter 60. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 2:54 a.m. We watched the boat explosion on Dietrich's laptop.
"Sweet," Skip murmured.
We were parked on the side of the road 3/4 of a mile from the plant, lights off.
"Christ," complained Bunny. "I'm boiling in this shit."
"Life's hard, ain't it?"
said Top, who was sweating as much as the rest of us, but didn't seem to care. I'm pretty sure that if Top Sims had an arrow stuck in his kidney, he wouldn't let the pain show on his face. Some guys are like that.
"Okay," yelled Gus Dietrich. "The 911 call just went through."
"Light her up," I told him, and the driver fired up the engine and punched on the lights and sirens. So far, our hastily formed plan was going well. One of Church's staff engineers had rigged a remote piloting unit to the cigarette boat that had been confiscated when the task force took the warehouse, and they'd gotten 2 store mannequins from God only knows where and strapped them into the front seats. Dietrich worked the remote controls and made quite a show by zigzagging the boat through the anchored pleasure craft and generally causing a ruckus. If there were any witnesses, they would report a drunk driving like a lunatic. The cigarette was loaded to the gunnels with gas cans and small C4 charges, which Dietrich radio detonated as soon as the boat struck the dock. It was way too big an explosion, more like something you see in movies. And it was damned impressive. Within minutes, we were being frantically waved through the open gates by the security guard. Our driver angled left and headed toward the big red-painted emergency standpipe, and as we squealed to a halt, everyone piled out. The second engine pulled closer to the dock, and we had calls in for 3 more engines to join us. That would put a lot of men and women in identical coats and helmets running around. A few of them would even be actual firefighters. Police cars seemed to appear by the dozen, state and local. I knew that Grace was in one of them, and Alpha Team was peppered throughout the rest. Church was in a command van parked around the bend in the access road, and the special ops teams were in vans behind him. Close. But would they be close enough if we encountered heavy resistance? As we piled out, Bunny and Top went directly to the standpipe, passing the line of parked cars and trucks that had been spotted by the spy satellite and helo surveillance. Skip and Ollie pulled a hose off the truck and began unlimbering it as they walked backward toward the pipe.
"Camera on my 2 o'clock, I heard Bunny say in my earpiece. "Slow rotation on a 90-degree swing."
"Copy that, I'm coming in. Give me some cover." They took their cue and began fitting a hose nozzle to the pipe. I closed on the group, watching the camera out of the corner of my eye. As soon as it swung toward the main part of the lot where all the activity was in full swing, I dashed forward and flattened against the wall in what I judged to be the dead spot beneath the box-style camera. When I ran to the wall, a firefighter moved from a point of concealment behind the door of the engine and hurried quickly over to take my place. We repeated this process 4 more times, and then Echo Team was all scrunched up against the wall, and real firefighters were attaching the hose to the pipe.
"Skip, eyes on the camera," I said.
Bunny removed a sensor from his pocket and ran it over every square inch of the door and then showed me the readout.
"Standard alarm contact switch," he said. "It'll go off when we open the door."
"Perfect. Ollie, go to work." Ollie had volunteered to tackle the lock, which was a heavy industrial affair.
He had to earn his pay, but in less than 2 minutes he had it unlocked. He kept the door closed, though, because the alarm would ring the second we opened it. If there was no one directly inside, then our carnival act was going to pay off. But if even one person was inside, then we were screwed as far as stealth went. "Okay," I said into the mic. "Call the cops." The signal was relayed and a big-shouldered state trooper came loping over. I motioned him to slow his walk so that the panning camera clearly caught him moving toward the door. And then as soon as it panned away, I waved him in and he ran the last few yards. I turned and pounded my fist hard on the door for 3 seconds, and then yanked open the door and we piled inside. Alarms began jangling loudly overhead. As soon as it closed, Ollie turned and re-engaged the lock, and the trooper took his cue and continued to beat on the door, shaking it in its frame. Immediately the five of us fanned out into a half circle, guns out, but we needn't have bothered. The room in which we stood was big, dirty, and empty. And cold. Like the meatpacking plant had been, maybe 35-40 degrees, with damp air and black mold on the walls. The floor was old tile and had a big gutter down its middle, and to our left was a low stone wall beyond which were oversized showers. There was a row of heavy pegs on which were still hung a couple of old oilskin jackets. This was where the crab fishermen must have come in after offloading their catch, to shower the seawater and crab gook off their foul weather gear before heading into the interior of the plant. There was a line of foul-smelling toilet stalls to our right, and the wall in front of us was set with rows of lockers. A corridor broke left past the lockers. All of it was visible in the piss-yellow glow of flickering fluorescent lights. I signaled Skip to watch the hall while the rest of us shucked our coats and helmets and stowed them out of sight in a shower stall. Skip signaled us by breaking squelch and then hand-signed that someone was coming. We all faded back. Ollie and Skip went into toilet stalls and crouched on the seats. Top and Bunny hid in shower stalls, and I crouched down behind the low concrete wall. I could only see around the edge of it, and there were shadows behind me, so I was pretty well hidden. I had my silenced Beretta ready in a two-hand grip as I strained to hear the footsteps through the jangling alarm. Right around the time we heard the running footsteps, the alarm stopped. The trooper continued to pound on the door, and now he was shouting, too, sounding genuinely outraged that no one had come to check out the fire. Then a man stepped into view with an AK-47 in his hands. He looked nervous and sweaty, his eyes round and white as he stared at the door. He licked his lips and looked around the shower room, but didn't see anything. We'd been careful not to scuff the floor. After a moment's indecision, he backpedaled, opened one of the lockers and put the assault rifle inside, closed it and pulled a small walkie-talkie from his jacket pocket. As he clicked it on, he moved into the spill of weak light from one of the few overhead fluorescents that still worked. He was Middle Eastern, with a receding hairline, short beard, and a beaky nose. "I'm at the back door," he said into the walkie-talkie, speaking in Waziri, a dialect from southern Iran. I could just about understand him. "No, the door is locked, but I think the firemen want to get in. They are banging on the door." He listened for a few moments, but the voice on the other end was too garbled for me to understand. "Okay," he said and clicked off the radio. In very good English, he yelled, all right, I'm coming." He pushed the door open, and the big state trooper filled the doorway with his bulk and shone his light right into the man's face. "Didn't you hear me knocking, sir? Didn't you hear the explosion? How can you not be aware that half the fire companies in the county are in your parking lot?" As ordered, the trooper went immediately into an outraged tirade, which provoked a defensive reaction in the other man, and within seconds the two of them were locked in a screaming match. It was clear the Iranian was regretting opening the door, but he was caught up in his role now, playing the part of a clueless and aggrieved worker who wants no part of something that happened on the docks. He made a lot of noise about being a supervisor for a crew mapping out renovations for a building that had already been sold. He shouted names and phone numbers for the police to call. He also told the cop to get the damn light out of his face, and he had to repeat that 3 times before the trooper did. Both the Iranian and the trooper could yell like fishwives. I checked my watch. The argument had lasted 2 minutes. Any second now another trooper would call the big guy away, and they'd allow the supervisor to go about his business. And sure enough, I heard Gus Dietrich calling the cop away.
"The fire marshal is going to need you to sign a release form," the trooper yelled.
"Sure, sure, fine. Don't harass me. This is bullshit. Here is the card for the lawyer who is handling things. He will be happy to handle whatever needs to be done."
The trooper snatched the card out of the Iranian's fingers and stormed off. It was all very impressive, with exactly the right amount of indignation. The Iranian pulled the door shut again and double-checked the lock. He keyed his walkie-talkie again and in rapid waziri relayed what was happening.
"Okay," he said at length. "I'm coming back."
He pocketed the radio, cast one last look around, retrieved his AK-47 from the locker and headed back along the hallway. I waited a full minute after the sound of his footfalls vanished before I stood up. The others crept out of hiding to join me.
"Skip, you watch the hall again," I whispered. "You see so much as a cockroach, you break squelch twice. Top, Bunny, I want you both to hold this position. Ollie, you're with me. Code names, here on out. Small arms only."
They nodded, and we began moving. Skip dropped down to a shooter's kneel using one of the rows of lockers as cover. There was enough light to see, but only just. And if it went lights out, we had night vision as backup. Bunny positioned himself behind the low wall so that it would serve as a bunker if we got chased. Top faded to the other side of the big room and vanished into a bank of shadows. Ollie looked down the shadowy corridor.
"Clear," he murmured.
We set off into the belly of the beast. Chapter 61. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 3:15 a.m. The building was quiet as a tomb and as cold as a meat locker. I hated that because of what it implied. All I could hear was the faintest hum from the refrigeration compressors on the far side of the warehouse. Our gum-rubber shoes made no sound as Ollie and I crept along, hugging the wall, looking for security cameras, moving from shadow to shadow. I knew from the schematics that there was a central corridor that ran the length of the building. That much was in the original floor plans, but the hallway in front of us didn't look long enough to go the whole way. We had no plans that showed renovations made since the plant went into receivership. The corridor ran straight for maybe 300 feet and then vanished in shadows that looked solid enough to be a wall. There were heavy steel doors set about every 10 yards, and as we moved up to the first one, we checked every inch of the floor, walls, and ceiling for cameras, and saw none. The first door we came to was set with a simple keycard lock, nothing that would slow us up for very long if we were in a hurry. "Bug," I said, and Ollie fished in his pocket and removed two tiny devices. The first was the size of a postage stamp and painted a neutral gray. He handed it to me, and I pulled off a clear plastic cover to expose the photosensitive chemicals, and then pressed it to the side of the metal door for 3 seconds. When I finished counting Mississippi's, I pulled the strip off and saw that it was now the same color as the door. I turned it over and removed the tape from the other side, exposing a strong adhesive, and then pressed it to the door at about knee level, below where the eye would not naturally fall when opening a door. I examined the results, and Ollie and I exchanged a raised eyebrows look. Unless you knew exactly where to look, the thing was invisible, blending in completely with the paint on the door. The little chameleon bugs were supposed to have incredible pickup and could relay info up to a quarter mile.
"Nice," Ollie said as he handed me the second device, a silver disc the size of a nickel.
I removed the adhesive backing and placed the device on the underside of the keycard box. The bug would do nothing until someone used a keycard to open the door, and then it would record the magnetic code and transmit it immediately to the DMS, where it would be processed through mind reader and the code signal would be sent back to us. We each carried master key cards that could be remote programmed by the DMS techs. Within 90 seconds of someone using a key card here, we'd all have cards with the same code. Our master key cards could store up to 6 separate card codes. Church really had nice toys, but I hoped it worked as well as promised. I tapped my earpiece.
"First one's in place."
We moved down the hallway and repeated the process at each door. Counting both sides of the hall, there were 11 doors in all. Then the hallway ended at a T-juncture, with shorter corridors branching at right angles.
"Split up," Ollie suggested.
I nodded.
"Break squelch once if you find anything, twice if you need me to come running."
"Roger that,"
he said, and melted away. This part of the building was badly lit, with fluorescent lights hanging from their wires like debris caught in some gigantic spider web. The ceiling was